We start today's program with higher education in Arizona. Following its most recent meeting, the Arizona Board of Regents has decided to ask the state legislature for additional funding for public universities, with a particular focus on in-state students. But since the Great Recession, lawmakers have not been inclined to restore money to ASU, NAU, and U of A that they had been receiving. So is this a different focus that will get lawmakers on board? With me to talk about that is Eileen Klein, president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Eileen, the budget that came out of the most recent legislative session saw public universities hit with nearly $100 million in cuts, considerably higher even than what Governor Ducey had proposed. What could lead to some of that money being restored?
Since the economic downturn, it's been obvious that the universities need to find a different model to be successful. Gone are the days where we can just count on being a state agency and being funded accordingly. And since the downturn, the university cuts have been on the order of about $460 million. So it's a significant change in the business plan. Ultimately, what we need to do is redefine the relationship with the state. And yes, of course, as part of that, try to make up for some lost ground. So some of the proposal does anticipate the legislature's support of restoring some of the unanticipated cuts from last session on the order of about $24 million, and then setting a new mark to go forward and really change the way in which we fund our universities.
Arizona is obviously not alone as part of this growing trend with state governments providing less money for higher education. Is that a blip or is that the new reality?
In Arizona, it certainly is the new reality, and we are seeing changes across the nation. This is an extremely dynamic period in higher education. There are enormous market forces at work, but ultimately we have a constitution and a constitutional obligation to uphold as public universities, and we need to make sure that we who are responsible for leading and governing the university system on behalf of the people here are creating a viable and sustainable higher education system so that in the future, all of our students have an opportunity to go to a quality public university at an affordable price. And it's very clear that the state is not going to be the primary funder, at least not anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at some of the key points as far as budget requests for fiscal year 2017. There's a one-time capital request of $75 million. What's part of that package?
There is an enormous amount of deferred maintenance and just pent-up demand for some additional capital investment. The state has had a long-standing formula that really has been disregarded for investing in university buildings, and we've taken care of the most urgent needs, to be sure. I want to make sure people understand that the buildings are safe at the universities, but there is some renovation that's needed at all three universities, and it's just making sure that we keep up with those most critical capital projects and having the state play a role in that. It's important that the state recognize that for resident students, you know, we want to be sure that there's money to support their education and the buildings that we need to get them educated in.
And there's also slightly more than $19 million requested for facility maintenance and operations. Playing off of that, you know, these are not especially ambitious requests considering what's come in the past. I mean, there were some major hopes for a large capital campaign that would have more research facilities, this kind of thing. Did the board have to become more practical just based on the way lawmakers have been acting lately?
The board is recognizing what the long-term outlook for the state general fund is going to be. And while we do anticipate growth, we're very optimistic and bullish about Arizona, it's very clear that the pressures around the state general fund are going to continue. So we need to find different models, different ways to generate the capital that we're going to need long-term. We want to have a longer-term conversation with policymakers around that. But the most important first order of business is to change the direction of the funding line between the state and the universities. We need to get that line going back up and not down so that the state is again investing in its public university system. We can't relegate the public universities to the bottom of the list when it comes to the needs. Our universities are too important for the future economic development of the state, certainly, and to really growing the talent that we need here and creating opportunities for individuals to have more successful lives.
Do you feel confident that going across with some of the things that the governor has said, creating more efficiencies and adding to even the innovation that's already there from the state's universities, that there will be this legitimate partnership? Do you feel like if you bring to the table what lawmakers and the governor seem to be asking for, they will follow through?
There is a lot of conversation going on right now with lawmakers where they do appreciate that we need a new path forward. They take their obligations very seriously, and I do believe they want to create opportunities for individuals. We believe that by focusing the funding on resident students, it really addresses what policymakers need to do most, which is create opportunities for higher education for the people who live in Arizona. And then the universities are freed up to figure out other ways to make the rest of the enterprise and its objectives work. But defining that relationship for policymakers so they understand clearly what they're investing in and then what the return to them will be is really important. So the universities over the past several years have been working on ambitious plans, setting goals, and keeping themselves to strict account for the outcomes around graduation and research productivity. All of those things are really important. But when you get right down to it, what we need the help from the policymakers on is funding education for students who are living in Arizona. And I think this proposal is going to be well received.
There are also four cornerstone goals. I'm curious if you can tell us about those and where does that fit into the greater picture, long-term and short-term?
So in the repositioning of the system overall, it was important to sit still and really think about what do we need our universities to be delivering for the public and for the people of Arizona who are investing in them. And ultimately, it comes down to, no surprise, educating individuals and leading the research and discovery agenda. Research and the translation of research into the marketplace are some of the most fundamental responsibilities of universities and really are the differentiators. It's what makes the difference between universities and other outlets of higher education. We need those offerings to remain strong. So we've put forward a set of goals. The governor had wanted to make sure that our strategic plan was updated, that it recognized the important role in particular that universities play in educating the future workforce talent in Arizona. And we wanted to make sure that we were being very ambitious in the outcomes that we want to see in terms of our total performance. So in November, we'll actually set targets, performance targets, to 2025, which is exciting. But right now, this has been an enormous effort working with university leadership statewide to really focus and say what it is we want our universities to be doing and all of the activities that really relate to driving those outcomes.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with the Arizona Board of Regents President Eileen Klein. Eileen, is there a perception among some, and this could be lawmakers or the public or whoever, that there is still this sort of ivory tower concept, even though we're talking about public universities? And is there any issue? I mean, I think the reality of life is that people who do a good job and do big jobs get paid a lot of money. But people have seen some of the raises recently that were approved for President Crow and Ann Weaver Hart and Rita Chang. Is there a concern that even if they deserve it, it doesn't look good?
Well, there is always going to be concern about salaries paid, whether it's to presidents or coaches or CEOs. And we understand that. And we want to be sure that, you know, we're sensitive that these are public institutions that serve a public purpose. But in Arizona, our presidents are not paid to preside. They are paid to perform. And some of the reports are really recognizing that part of our president's salary is placed at risk. They don't get certain portions of their compensation if they're not performing. And by performing, we mean really driving the outcomes around student success, making sure our students are graduating, that greater numbers of students are graduating, and that overall university performance is very strong. So in Arizona, we place portions of university presidents' compensation at risk, and they do not get paid if they don't hit those marks. And it's an all or nothing proposition. So if they don't hit the numbers, they don't see the compensation. Having said that, you know, we want to be careful that everything we do is adding value, and we're always going to want to make sure that we are paying competitive wages, but that we are also respecting that we are public institutions. So striking that balance is a very important objective for us.
Eileen, finally, you had to make the rounds recently about recent numbers indicating that a strikingly small percentage of Arizona's high school graduates could make it in the state's universities. Does that indicate, and are there efforts underway to get higher education components sort of more involved in K-12 in Arizona? Because everyone has concerns about K-12 here, whether it's the funding or whether it's the standards or whether it's the results.
An important goal of the new strategic plan for the public universities is educational attainment in Arizona. The regents have made a strong claim to saying that it needs to start with us and just having people understand the importance of higher education in Arizona. And we want to work to build a coalition so that we can create more of a college-going culture in Arizona. And I've said often that it doesn't mean everybody has to go to a public research university, but we want students to have ambitions for something after high school. I think our refreshed strategic plan, along along with changing our funding model to focus on funding for resident students so that students know that there is state funding waiting for them when they complete their high school diploma is pretty exciting. I hope that will lead to the creation of more college-eligible students in Arizona, and we can continue to foster this alignment that's so needed between us and K-12. But setting that ambition and really getting all of Arizona behind post-secondary education is something that we all need to pay attention to, and we're starting to beat the drum around that.
Eileen Klein is president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Eileen, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the time.
And still to come on Here and Now, the controversy continues to brew over the Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home in Arcadia. We'll get a couple of different perspectives on that. And then later on this hour, humorist Lori Nataro joins us in studio. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting a tribute to the brave as Civil War, World War I, and II imagery are projected above the orchestra while performing Shostakovich and Copland live, October 2nd through 4th. PhoenixSymphony.org.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. It's mostly sunny across the state right now, 90 degrees in Tucson, 93 in Casa Grande, it's 84 in Prescott, 77 degrees in Flagstaff, 96 in Yuma. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now, westbound on the US 60 freeway, watch out for restrictions on the exit ramp at Mesa Drive. Northbound on the I-17 at 7th Street, though, all lanes are now back open. If you're a sustaining member, your reliable monthly donations help keep the focus on news and information and less on fundraising. Are you in? Your secure ongoing gift of $5 or $10 a month will feel great. Click I'm in at kjzz.org. It's partly sunny right now in Phoenix and 95 degrees at 1119.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The conflict over a Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home in the Arcadia area is continuing. Attorney Zach Rawling owns the property and has proposed turning it into an educational and cultural facility that would be a teaching tool for multiple generations. And earlier this month, Rawling submitted a partial application to make the property a historic landmark. Opposition to keeping the home intact and helping it avoid bulldozers has been relatively limited, but the most dramatic split has occurred over Rawling's specific plans. Some neighbors believe they'll simply bring noise and traffic to the residential area. With me to talk about the David and Gladys Wright House is Vanessa Hickman, former state land commissioner who's consulting on the project. Vanessa, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
So where are we at on the historic designation? And if, in fact, it goes to full fruition, what would that mean?
Certainly. So on behalf of the foundation, we filed the application in mid-September for a historic preservation landmark designation. The application is moving through the review process at the City of Phoenix, and we will likely have our first public hearing in November in front of the Historic Preservation Commission. Our goal is to be heard on the November 16th agenda of the Historic Preservation Commission. We will be filing an application for a special permit later in the process, likely in mid-November, after we've had our first public hearing on the historic preservation element of the overall proposal. The application for the historic preservation landmark designation would preserve 6.1 acres of property in Arcadia that was historically citrus groves, in the center of which is the Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home and guest house. And our goal is to preserve the home and the guest house and to open the home to the public and allow educational, artistic, and cultural events to occur on site.
Considering the location, very residential area, what do you make of some of the concerns that some in the neighborhood have expressed, saying that, well, the house has a historic, it feels historic to us because it's a Frank Lloyd Wright house, but when we bought a house nearby, we didn't really bargain for this kind of thing. In the greater picture of legacy, why do you think it's important?
Our goal is to be invisible and inaudible to the neighborhood, and we will be building in restrictions within the special permit that will help guarantee that the uses on the property are not uses which will interfere with the quality of life of the neighborhood. And in fact, we would put forward that the Frank Lloyd Wright home will actually serve as an amenity to the neighborhood, serving as a public space in the center of Arcadia that people can enjoy and use as they're walking through the neighborhood and enjoy the various cultural events that are going on the property. The mission of the foundation is to preserve, celebrate, and inspire through the use of the home. The masterpiece that was created by Frank Lloyd Wright is one of a kind and one that is very worthy of saving and also worthy of opening for public viewing. For many years, it was essentially kept from public view because it was used as a private residence. And now we have this amazing opportunity to invite the public in and to be inspired by the design and the artistic elements, which will lead to future creativity in our youth and others that view the property.
Well, so Vanessa, how much of preservation is about sort of the greater good in this area? Because there have been some who've said, okay, we understand the concerns of the neighbors, but what you have laid out makes it really a more of a bonus for people who don't live a block away. It's for about people in the surrounding area of the community, the Greater Valley.
The property itself has an opportunity to be an amenity not only for the Arcadia residents, but also an amenity for the state and a national and international level. It is a draw to Arizona to have a Frank Lloyd Wright structure of this magnitude located in the Arcadia area. So I don't think the discussion is between doing something for the greater good versus something else, because what we're trying to achieve at the end of the day does serve everybody's interests, because we're trying to put something forward which will have the protections in place so that there is no sacrifice for the greater good that is taking place. What is going to occur is something that will be something the city of Phoenix can be proud of and its residents can be proud of.
As former state land commissioner, you have a lot more knowledge of this kind of thing than the rest of us. So when it comes to setting up the way the property would be used and what you're laying out, I think there's probably trust but verify there for a lot of people who live in the neighborhood. So why would they feel confident that what you're saying will in fact end up being the result, even if what you're saying is right on the mark?
So part of the discussion that we've seen so far has been based on uncertainty and fear of the unknown. We have not yet filed the application for the special permit. The application will lay out information and studies related to traffic, lighting, noise, and use of the property, which will allow us to have a starting point for conversation as it pertains to use of the property and the type of safeguards that will be in place for the neighborhood. So once that application is filed, we can have that open, free-flowing dialogue, the back and forth between the neighborhood residents that have some concerns and the property owner. At this point, the property is pursuing the Historic Preservation Landmark designation, and we're confident that through education of the intended uses and improvements on the property, working together and putting in the protections that need to be approved by City Council, we can achieve the certainty and security of the neighborhood. There's always some level of trust that goes into a land use decision when you're working with a property owner that would like to improve the property, restore the property, or do something different than what's already in place. But we will have a review period that's built into the approved permit, and we'll also be transferring the title to a nonprofit organization to ensure that the property is used for nonprofit and civic purposes as intended and as we will further discuss as part of the process.
Vanessa, last thing for you. This has been sort of a long-running drama. How much is this, I don't know if it's making it even more dramatic when I put it this way, but how much of a case study is this for Phoenix and preservation, the fact that Phoenix is a younger city compared to many of cities in the East and whatnot and their preservation practices? What can this sort of teach us one way or the other about that?
So it's very interesting. Some of the material that's already been written about what is occurring in Arcadia is coming from sources outside of the valley. And some have looked at this property and have said the historic preservation that's occurred in Phoenix, while laudable, there's been nothing quite of this level and nothing of this magnitude at stake as what we have at stake with the Frank Lloyd Wright House and the Dave and Gladys Wright House. So we need to pay attention. This is something of a very large scale and something that does merit great attention in trying to ensure that the home is preserved for Phoenix residents and for and on a national scale. What's unusual about this case is that you have a property owner that's actually looking to preserve more acreage than what was originally contemplated. Often with historic preservation cases, you have a situation where there is a body coming in that's trying to preserve the very scarce amount of property that's left before it is demolished and subdivided or used for another purpose. But in this case, you've got somebody that has come in with a goal of preserving as much area as possible in order to restore the full integrity and setting of the design of Frank Lloyd Wright. So in that sense, it's very unusual and certainly worth a case study as you look at the reaction that has occurred by a small group that have raised some concerns over a few isolated issues that we feel confident that we can address as we move down the road. But I would look forward to reading any sort of piece on what is currently occurring. And I'm also interested in reading a retrospective on the great purpose and the great use that this serves in the city of Phoenix 15 years from now as we look and see what we have, hopefully after this case is approved down the road.
And Vanessa, very, very briefly, what's the timeline we should look for? You mentioned November 16th, but if in fact this all plays out, what's the next big date after that we should look for?
So November 16th is our goal for the Historic Preservation Commission. We should receive certainty on that date in the next few weeks. After that, we will be going to the Camelback East Village, the Planning Commission, and eventually the City Council. We're looking at early 2016 for City Council, likely February or March. We'll also be filing our special permit in mid-November, and we will have neighborhood meetings on both the historic preservation application, a neighborhood meeting later in October, and then a neighborhood meeting once we've filed the special permit so that we have all of the information in front of those that are interested in the project that can lead to that rich dialogue that we have not yet been able to have because the information has not yet been ready to distribute and disseminate.
Vanessa Hickman is Arizona's former state land commissioner. Vanessa, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Steve.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're talking about the conflict over the David and Gladys Wright House in Arcadia. With another perspective for a few minutes is longtime resident and activist Paul Barnes. Paul, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
So tell us a little bit about what happened last night. There was a public meeting at Ingleside Middle School. What was the turnout like, and did people hear from different sides, or was it one point of view?
There were approximately 500 people there, perhaps a little in excess, and the purpose of the meeting was basically to enable the Arcadia neighborhood and the neighborhood association to get across to the people that were in attendance the right facts about the Wright House. In other words, what we really see is the situation from our point of view. The other side has been very active with a public PR campaign, and frankly, a lot of the information that's been given out has been very misleading.
What bothers you most about what you've at least heard about the plan so far, whether that's what actually comes to fruition? What have you seen, what have you heard that worries you?
Initially, I was very, very much involved going back to 2012. I purposely and personally lobbied to support saving the house. And we also supported the landmark overlay. But at that time, we were talking about 2.45 acres and a very modest special permit that would allow certain things to take place at the house. What we're looking at now is far in excess of that. They're talking about 6.1 acres and at least two of those acres to the northern part of what they would like to include had absolutely nothing to do with any of the Wright interests. It was never owned by any of the Wright people. So now we're looking at 6.1 acres. We're looking at significant numbers of events. They're operating. They want to keep open from early till 10 o'clock at night for 7 days a week, except closing at 8 on Sundays. They want all sorts of events. They want to be able to have paid attendance of up to 500 people, commercial weddings, sale of beer and wine. All of those things were not contemplated at all when we originally supported preservation of the house. And we still do support preservation of the house. It's just we want to scale back to what we were looking at in 2012.
Paul, I think that's where I really want to get your, you know, short historical perspective, not going back, you know, more than a few years, but you mentioned 2012. A lot of people hear a Frank Lloyd Wright designed home, and not only do their ears perk up, but they think, well, that is an important part of Arizona's legacy, the Valley's legacy in many ways. What was it about the property, though, that led to Mr. Rawling ended up buying this? Because there was such an effort to preserve the house. It does seem like most people would like the house to remain in some form or fashion. Why is it
Correct.
So hard to get someone to buy in this beautiful area and buy a house that was Frank Lloyd Wright designed? Why did it end up coming to this?
Well, there were people that had bought the house, and they had bought it for speculation. They wanted to divide the property and split the house basically in half.
Okay.
In other words, they were developers, so they were. It was a real estate type transaction, and they wanted to maximize their profits.
And so, in essence, so there wasn't someone who really wanted to buy it to raise a family there?
Correct.
Okay. Does that surprise you, considering the historic legacy there?
Doesn't surprise me, because these days there's a lot of developers, there's a lot of people in real estate, and some of them just simply want to maximize profit, and they don't necessarily look at what it is they're tearing down or destroying.
Let me ask you a little bit about the surrounding neighborhood, because I want your perspective as someone who's lived there for a long time. Is this a case of feeling like people who are on the other side not understanding the perspective of longtime neighbors? You know, when you bought the house, maybe you weren't thinking there would be an educational museum, a place where people could come and attend and learn more about Frank Lloyd Wright. You were thinking about, I would like to live here and you know, ride my bike up and down the street or whatnot. Do you think there's a perspective that's missing there, where it's folks are not necessarily, wouldn't necessarily be as excited about having it in their neighborhood?
I think that's definitely true. And what we feel is, frankly, it's turning into more of a development than as a preservation effort. In other words, properties to the north, two houses were bought and have been torn down, and they're leveled, and now you're looking at dirt. And they want to do this so they can increase the size of the events and the types of revenue-producing activities that they're going to conduct on the property.
Paul, finally, as someone, again, who's been a longtime activist, do you envision the sides coming to the table again and coming up with some sort of compromise that at least both sides can feel both good and bad about, as most compromises are?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult unless they will go back to what we were talking about in 2012. You know, otherwise you're basically asking the neighbors not necessarily to compromise, but to surrender.
Arcadia resident Paul Barnes, we've been talking about the David and Gladys Wright House. Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. It certainly seems like Arizona would be a haven for solar energy production and use, but recent conflicts among the state's utilities and some solar companies has industry observers saying Arizona's on the verge of falling behind. In the new book, Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future, Philip Warburg writes about his personal experience with solar and its broader impact. Philip, thanks for joining us.
Great to be on your show.
So give us an idea about your personal experience. You know from personal experience what rooftop solar is like. How has it played a role in your life?
Well, in chilly, snowy New England, I'm from Massachusetts, we now have a solar array on our home that gets 75% of our power, and that includes the nightly charging of a plug-in electric vehicle. I think one thing that people don't always know is the somewhat counterintuitive fact that solar photovoltaics actually do better in colder weather. In Arizona, you certainly have superabundant sun, which more than makes up for the heat there. But we do just fine in New England as well.
Well, so what differences have you noticed? Because I think that would surprise a lot of people. Are there other differences you've noticed with your writing and your research that solar is used differently in different parts of the country? Again, our perception is that Arizona should be dominant in this. But, of course, Oregon does quite well, and Oregon is not a place that is at nearly as sunny as Arizona is.
Well, solar has enormous potential really across the country. Arizona has about 327 times the current electricity use in solar potential. So that's pretty phenomenal. But then you look at a place like New Jersey, which ranks number three in the country in installed solar capacity. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly the sunniest state. It's a small state. It's an industrialized state. And what you see happening there is a lot of giant warehouse roofs, for example, provide a great opportunity for solar development. So you're switching off of fossil fuels in providing the power to those facilities. You see landfills across the country that are being converted to solar. Brownfield solar, as it's called, solar on contaminated or potentially contaminated properties, could be generating about three times our total power needs nationwide. We have a superabundant solar resource, and we can tap it in various ways in various parts of the country.
Do you envision a time, maybe in the near future, maybe the distant future, where traditional environmentalists and what we would label capitalists can work together to help the environment, so not using fossil fuels, not using them to the degree that we use them, but also using solar, using other alternative energy to create good, high-paying jobs?
This isn't some hypothetical about the future. This is today. There are about 174,000 jobs in the solar industry today, and we have capitalists, investors, home installers, and the like, manufacturers very actively engaged in the solar industry. It's an opportunity that is being taken advantage of, not because of its environmental virtues, but because people see it as the smart way to go, the economical way to go, and that will become more the case as we see fossil fuels face increasing regulation, which they should, regarding their greenhouse gas emissions. Solar is a very promising technology. And one of the interesting things for me, observing what has been going on in Arizona, is you have an interesting coalition of progressives who are very much renewable energy advocates and libertarians who are saying, we want solar on our rooftops and we want to be compensated appropriately for that solar power. That, to me, is a hopeful sign in a very fractious political era.
Hopeful sign. I would agree with you. It's interesting you bring up that point because there is the feeling here that, again, because it's Arizona, we wonder why people are fighting about it. There are some critics who've said that the utilities want to maintain some kind of monopoly and that that in some ways is driving away certain solar companies. From an economic perspective, are there going to be other states, you mentioned New Jersey, that take advantage of this? Or could you see other states having the same sort of utility versus private company fight we've seen here?
I think we're at a very profound transformational moment for electric utilities. They've been defining themselves really as generators of kilowatt hours that they then sell. If they're going to survive well into the 21st century, they're going to have to become energy services providers. And that's going to mean getting involved in providing storage. That's going to involve what's called demand response, where you're using the available electricity resources much more appropriately and time-sensitively. And there are lots of opportunities for a much more flexible and resilient utility industry. And if the utilities just continue to see themselves as only generating electrons, they're going to be in trouble. I think they need to take a warning from the Kodak and Polaroid experiences and not recognizing the digital photography era when it was upon them. Utilities are going to have to adapt. And I think that's a huge opportunity and a wonderful opportunity because we can diversify our energy resources and develop a more sustainable energy resource base, but we can only do so if the utility sector accommodates and adapts.
Philip, in our last couple of minutes, I want to make sure we touch on a couple of communities that may not be talked about quite as much, and that's Native American communities, which are very important here in Arizona, and lower-income communities. Are we going to see expansion of solar among those communities, and what will it take?
Well, let's start with the Native American communities. I did visit a number of Native American communities in Arizona, and I would say the story there is a mixed one. First, I should say that on 2% of America's land, Native Americans have about 5% of the nation's solar potential. So that's good news. What's a little bit frustrating is that the progress within the Native American community so far has been really one of, I would say, fits and starts. The Moapa Paiute in Nevada are developing large-scale, utility-scale solar projects, actually selling their power to the L.A. Department of Water and Power. In Arizona, I visited the San Carlos Apache tribe. They were considering installing a solar array on their Apache Gold Casino, but as I understand it, they have since set that project aside. I spoke with people in the Gila River Indian community, and there was reference to the possibility of developing some solar, but there was certainly nothing explicitly on the table that they could at least share at that point. So I hope that we're just at the very beginning of a recognition within the Native American community of how important solar could be. And, you know, time will tell. And it's a very new industry, and caution is appropriate in communities that have scarce resources. But the Native American land resources are prodigious and really do provide a wonderful economic opportunity for them to, frankly, shift away from coal, which has been such a huge source of dependence for many Native American communities.
Philip,
in terms of low-income solar,
yes, but please,
California
briefly.
Is really – sorry?
Briefly, please.
Yeah. California is really leading the way. It's devoting about $300 million to getting solar into low-income communities. That's a model that we should be following in other states. It's a very important way to reduce people's electric bills while trimming our greenhouse gas emissions.
The name of the book is Harness the Sun, America's Quest for a Solar-Powered Future. We've been talking with the author, Philip Warburg. We just scratched the surface, Philip, but thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still to come on Here and Now, Arizona's monsoon season ends today, so how wet was it? We'll find out. And then we'll talk with humorist and author Lori Notaro. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, presenting the October Economic Club of Phoenix Luncheon with Speaker Cliff Burrows, Group President of Starbucks, Thursday, October 8th. Registration at ecpphoenix.com.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now at 91.5 and KJZZ.org. A sunny week for the valley. High today expected to be 106. It'll be 105 tomorrow and then dropping down to 98 degrees on Friday. In Valley traffic, southbound on the Loop 101 freeway right now, the Thunderbird exit ramp is now clear, as is the US 60 exit at Mesa Drive. Stay with us today at 12 for Here and Now from Boston. The fight for the Afghan city of Kunduz continues with U.S. Special Forces now involved. And the surprise meeting between Pope Francis and Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk who refused to issue same-sex marriage licenses. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon. Right now, it's partly sunny in Phoenix and 95 degrees at 11:46.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Today marks the final day of the 2015 monsoon season in Arizona, and in the course of the last 3.5 months or so, we had some huge rainstorms, selective microbursts, and other days with high expectations for wetness that ultimately came up dry. So where does this monsoon rank in Arizona history, and how did it affect the overall area? With me for a few minutes to talk about that is Paul Inyegeth, meteorologist and operations manager at the National Weather Service's Phoenix office. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so how did this monsoon season measure up?
Well, if we look at the airport, which is our official observing station, we've had 3.29 inches there today, which will go down as the 35th wettest, and that's with our records going back to 1850. 1996, so about 120 years worth of data there. But if you look at the city as a whole, you know, downtown was actually one of the wetter spots. Rainfall from downtown over into Tempe and Mesa ranged from 3 to 5 inches. In the metro area itself, the using data from the flood control district, the wettest observation, the gauge they had there, was 5.5 inches, and that was in that was at ASU campus. If you go further north, though, parts of the North Valley, especially up around 101 and 17, they basically didn't get any rain at all this summer.
Now, Paul, I'm going to be one of these amateur weather observers.
Aren't we all?
I guess you can be both, Paul. But there's frustration with when there's pouring rain, let's say, in certain areas. We're off the Broadway curve here, and we've seen some unbelievable storms. You mentioned some areas of downtown Phoenix, the East Valley, the West Valley. That official gauge drives many of us nuts. That Sky Harbor thing.
It is how it is, right? I mean, we have one gauge that we're going to use and we have long-term records for, but we do have, we did create a rainfall index a number of years ago to try to capture how much rain falls across the Phoenix area, because I mean, Phoenix is a very big city, right? I mean, from east to west, it's stretching about 60, 70 miles, north to south, maybe 40 miles. It's every time it rains, it's very unlikely that everyone's going to see rain. That's just not the nature of the storms during the summertime and for such a large area. So looking at that rainfall index, which we have about 20 years of data for, this monsoon was the second driest in those 20 years. And compare that to last year, you know, we got about 8 times as much rain last year on an average across the city as we had this year.
Yeah, well, we had those incredible storms in early September last
year.
Do we have anything even close to that this time around?
We did have that near call last week where we were watching very closely a tropical system coming up here, and it looked very promising, you know, just about until it got here, and then it decided to strengthen and move off to the east. So we were looking at a pretty good rainfall event, and that didn't happen. But this September, you know, in September, that's when we can get those tropical systems in here, and they can bring some pretty widespread heavy rainfall.
Are we seeing more microbursts, Paul, or does it just seem that way?
I do not think we are seeing more.
Okay.
You know, every thunderstorm that develops here during the summertime is going to definitely have the potential to produce that downburst signature. They can cause, as we see, damage. Not always. It's just, one thing we see is that there's just more and more city out there for these winds to cause damage to. So when that happens, it's going to get reported. It may seem like there's more of them happening, but there's just as many of them happening out in the open desert, not damaging anything.
So we're sort of going out with a whimper because the last couple of days have seen sort of near record high temperatures, sunny, pretty dry. What's the next rainstorm we could see? A possibility of early next week?
We're looking at a low probability right now,
okay,
Seeing some rain next week. Weather patterns, you know, it's fall, things are starting to change and shift, and so it's a little difficult to get a handle on what's going to happen right now. So we're looking at potentially some rain next week, but not a lot. It's looking at this point if it does happen.
And now, of course, we have to put that in our rearview mirror, Paul. So now I want to look ahead to potential winter. We've been hearing about more El Nino activity possibility. Could this be, now remember, this is on tape, so you might want to watch what you say. But how wet do you think this winter could be in the valley, and how much of a snowpack could we get up north?
So I'm a meteorologist, so I don't speak in absolutes, right, when trying to predict the future.
Right.
The El Nino, which is the warming of the water out in the Pacific Ocean along the equator, is there. It's already there, and very high probability that that's going to continue through the winter. And so that's going to impact our weather patterns here in the western U.S. Typically, when we get these strong El Ninos, we do see above average rainfall across Arizona, and we are indicating with pretty high probability, about 60-70%, that we're going to have an above average winter. So I can't necessarily give you any numbers as far as rainfall and snowpack, though, because if you just go a little bit above average, technically that's, you know, a win above average.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing we do have to consider, though, when we get into snowpack is that these storms, as they're going to be coming in through the wintertime, and it's probably typically we see again with these strong El Ninos, they don't really get going in earnest until December, maybe even into the early part of next year. So when it's not raining in November, people, you know, keep that in mind that, you know, this thing's a whole bust. So, but they come from tropical origin, so it's going to be pretty warm air that's coming with that. So that may push the snow levels higher than what we typically see during the winter.
Paul Inugeth is operations manager and meteorologist of the National Weather Service's Phoenix office. Paul, thanks for the time.
No problem.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. There are a lot of things to make fun of in Arizona, which I guess is why humorist Lori Nataro left the valley for the Pacific Northwest. She comes back periodically to make fun of the rest of us, enjoy authentic Mexican food, and to teach humor writing. She'll be doing that last thing this Saturday from 11 a.m. until 2 p.m. at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix. She's also just released a new collection of some of her vintage writing. It's called Enter Pirates. And now Lori Nataro is with me in studio. Hi.
Hello, Steve.
Welcome back. Good to have
you
here.
Thank you.
All right, so you're going to teach humor writing, and I've read your writing for so many years. You're not going to teach people what you do, right? Or are you? Because how do you? I mean, you have this natural voice.
Well, you know, the thing was, is when I taught classes kind of like at ASU at Lane Community College up in Eugene. And when they were saying, you know, like, teach a writing class. At first, I was like, the same thing. I was like, you can't do that. You just have to, either you have to do like a lot of drugs, or you have to have some like, you know, inner problems, a really bad childhood, which I did not have that, mom. My mother's listening. I had a great childhood. She was awesome. But when I actually started to sit down and think about it, I thought, oh my God, if you deconstruct it, if you take a joke, like how I start my classes is I take a David Sedaris joke and I say, what word makes this funny? Why is this funny? Let's really think about this and take it apart. And once you do that, it completely makes sense to me how things are funny. You just take something that's true and you twist it just a little bit and add a little bit of embarrassment or a little bit of an exaggeration, and you pretty much always hit the spot. So that's how it works.
I'm not sure if anybody cares what I think about this, but when I read your stuff, what makes it so funny to me is that it feels like this is the real person. It feels like you're getting stuff out there, that you have developed your unique voice. So, you know, can you encourage people to do that? How long did it take? I mean, do you feel like you are comfortable with this humorous voice?
Yeah, well, it's me.
Yeah, good. That's it. Yeah.
This is everyday me. This is, you know, my parents are both really funny people. They don't know that, but they are. They're hilarious. And what I really want to do is while I'm here, I want to do a blog between my parents and myself every morning. But I can't figure out how to tape them without my mother figuring out that I'm taping her. And now the gig is up. It's just, they're going to know that. But they're both really funny. So I grew up in a very, you know, we're Italian American. They're Catholic. So there's that repression. You're always dirty. You're always bad. Everything's, you're going to hell. It's like that kind of thing. So I guess it was just a natural reaction for me to try to deflect some of that stuff and either not care about it or make fun of it. And then I got fat, and I really had to figure out a way of how to deal with that and Spanx and the summertime and sweat and make it funny so it was actually livable.
Now, this is a daytime public radio show, but I'm going to risk reading the title of one of your stories in Enter Pirates, which is called That Bitch from the Paper.
Yeah.
Which focuses on how everyone hates you. Now,
that's true.
Did they really hate you? And if so, why did they hate you?
I didn't even know this. And this is when I was writing for the State Press at ASU. And I used to go to Long Wong's when Long Wong's was the big bar on Mill Avenue back in the heyday when Long Wong's was there and Mill Avenue was still cool and the Jim Blossoms and Dead Hot Workshop were playing. And I walked in one day and I interrupted two of my friends who were both in bands, and they were saying, you know, oh my God, my girlfriend hates you. And then Mark Zubia said, oh my God, my girlfriend hates you too. And I was like, what? Why do your girlfriends hate me? And they're like, everyone hates you. And I was like, really? Because I didn't think that I was that terrible or nasty. But I think there was just something about being out there, I suppose. I mean, they're not jealous of my beauty. Let's just put it that way. You know, it's not like I'm not Angelina Jolie. You know, there's no reason to be jealous of me on that level. But I think that maybe because I had a voice and maybe because I was a little bit obnoxious and I didn't really care what people thought, it was taken as a bit of maybe bravado. I don't know.
Well, now, were you hated, I'm putting it in quotes, were you hated by males and females? Because I was wondering if you're just...
Girls.
Okay, so yeah, maybe girls. You're just like a guy's girl. Like, you can hang out, you can be yourself, tell jokes.
Yeah, I could drink with the rest of them, I guess. So so that was fine. But the girls in particular, the ones who didn't know me, I mean, I certainly had some friends in that, you know, in that scene. But for the most part, people just really, the girls didn't care for me at all.
Now, this is a huge collection of stories, but one more that stood out to me is Permed, which obviously the way you tell everything is hilarious, but what about this one? Why was this one? Because this is something that a lot of, mostly females have experienced, this feeling about after they get permed.
I don't know. My hair is naturally curly. My mother will tell you that it's not, but it is. And it took me like 40 years to realize that. So like in the 90s, I'm like, I'm going to perm my hair. And then it turned out crazy. And then I realized I went to when ABCO was still here,
sure.
I realized that I had ABCO hair. Like I had all the
ABCO
hair.
ABCO is an old supermarket. Yeah.
Now it was Alpha Beta. Now right. It's all Safeway. But I realized that I had the same hair as all the cashiers in downtown Phoenix. And I was like, oh my God. So I had to re-perm my hair the same day and straighten it out, and then it just turned into corn husk hair. So that was...
Yeah, but what a friend of yours gave you some tips in there, and they didn't sound like cheap tips either.
It was Laura Greenberg from Phoenix Magazine. I was interning at the time, and she was like, okay, now you need to do, because everyone had done it. And she's got naturally curly hair too, and she had been permed. So it was crazy. I'm so glad that pressure on women is over. That era is over for now. Permed. It'll probably come back in 5 years, but for now we're safe. We're okay.
So Enter Pirates is 1991 to 1999.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm guessing you're not the one who saved all these columns. So maybe you were.
No, I wasn't. There was, you know, when I started at State Press, this was 1991, we didn't have email. There was no such thing. Yeah. I was working on green screen computers. So, and I'm a lazy person by nature, so I wasn't saving any of my stuff on floppies. I saved parts of it, but then I didn't save everything. So I had some hard copies of the State Press. I mean, by now, they're like 30 years old. And then in different moves, and then we had a flood in the basement, and all those hard copies got lost. And my grandmother died 7 years ago, and because we're a family of denial, we kept her house completely intact for 7 years until my sister moved into it earlier this summer. And she was like, oh my God, I just found this Giorgio Armani bag of all of your columns that Nana had saved through all of these years.
Wow.
And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. And so she sent me some, and I was like, you know what? These aren't too bad. But it was like kind of playing This Is Your Life. You know, I was just like, oh my God, I had been permed. I didn't remember that. Like, people hated me at Long Longs. I didn't remember that. So it was like kind of like flashbacks of all these crazy things. And I thought, you know what? Let me put these together and see how they do. Because Random House had just put Idiot Girls, which is my first book, 2002 release, on an ebook special on Amazon and iTunes. And that book, 15 years later, went back on the New York Times list. 15 years later.
See, that
later.
Means other people are going to start hating you now because of that.
I mean, I didn't make any money from it.
Yeah,
you know, don't think that. But it got back up there. So that made me think, people still do want to hear about that really irresponsible borderline alcohol. Lori Notaro. So we did it.
Lori, I wish we had more time.
Can I say one thing? I'm speaking tonight, reading tonight at the Crescent Ballroom, 7 o'clock. It's $10. I'm reading a brand new piece with a whole bunch of other readers. It's going to be awesome.
And also on Saturday, you'll be at Changing Hands Bookstore, the Phoenix location, teaching humor writing from 11 to 2. And new collection of some of Lori's vintage writing is called Enter Pirates. Lori, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much to our senior producer, Sarah Ventry, and Bruce Drummond for their help. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to catch any of this program later today or any of our previous shows, go to kjzz.org or download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great rest of the day. It is 12 o'clock. Mm-hmm.